Confronting racism and taking meaningful action. In some parts of the country, protests over racial injustice may have subsided, but in other parts, George Floyd's name is still being chanted and calls for justice continue. Regardless of the state of the protests, the national consciousness has been raised, and many people wonder where to go from here. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me for a conversation about what steps individuals can take to move toward real change and to actively confront the attitudes and policies that perpetuate racism. We'll discuss how some actions, such as removing statues and renaming buildings, may address the symbols of racism, but that the harder work of tackling racial oppression and trauma goes beyond these actions. How to take meaningful action in the fight against racism. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Taking time out of your schedule to join a protest or reading a book on anti-racism, these are among the steps that many have taken in recent months to support the fight against systemic racism. But are there more meaningful and more lasting steps to be taken, particularly by white people? Today, we'll explore this complicated issue. Our guests today are Noelle Chaddock, Vice President of Equity and Inclusion at Bates College, and Beth Hinderleiter, Assistant Professor at James Madison University. As always, we want to hear from you. In what ways have you looked inward to see how you might be perpetuating racism? Have you had difficult conversations with others about white privilege or implicit bias? What questions do you have about what you can do to help promote change? Share your thoughts. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Noelle, Beth, thanks for joining us. Noelle, I'm going to ask you the first question just to frame this discussion. As soon as we talk about race, people can get defensive or confused. So let's start with just identifying what we're talking about. When people say they want to support Black Lives Matter or they're going to a protest to fight for change, what exactly is the problem we're trying to address?
Thank you so much, Cindy, and thank you everyone who's listening today. Great question. So I think the framing of this is the ways in which we are thinking about how folks who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, the Black Lives Matters movement, and the intersection with, I think, what some folks are terming white consciousness, or the sudden moment where white people appreciate that they have done things directly, indirectly, and generationally that have negatively impacted, suppressed, oppressed, and caused these violent moments, including death for Black people, Indigenous people, people of color in the United States. And I'm going to use the term BIPOC, which is Black, Indigenous, people of color, and speak very specifically to Blackness in the United States and anti-Black violence, because that's the moment that we're in, and it doesn't mean that the other kinds of violence and racism are not important, but I think for white folks right now, it really is a sudden moment where they appreciate that not only have they and are they continuing to contribute to the conditions that make Black lives untenable in the United States, that they also have a role to play in disrupting racism, anti-Black racism, and dismantling white supremacy and the policies that support that. And I think I just want folks to really take a minute and ground into the reality that this is all of our work. Black folks, people of color, Indigenous folks did not create the system, the structure, and are not necessarily the ones actively benefiting from that structure or propping it up in the ways that we understand we have to push against in the United States.
So a lot there to digest, but I'm going to ask you an even simpler question. Is there a way to just define racism?
Sure. I mean, there is the institutional systemic definition of racism, which is the act of oppressing, denying access to, discriminating against, excluding people based on their race, and very specifically that racism requires a dynamic positionality of the person who's enacting it. So racism has the end consequence and result of denying folks things like social mobility and access in ways that Black, Indigenous people of color in the United States cannot actually do. And I know that is confusing for folks, the difference between racism and bias and discrimination.
I'm going to go to you, Beth, because you and Noelle worked together on a book that was just published in the fall. Congratulations on that. It's called Antagonizing White Feminism, Intersectionality's Critique of Women's Studies and the Academy. Can you explain what the message of that book was and how it ties into the current moment of racial justice and people protesting?
Great. Thank you for that question. Yeah, the book that Noelle and I are co-editors of, which was released back in November, called Antagonizing White Feminism, Intersectionality's Critique of Women's Studies and the Academy. And in it, we're trying to do a lot of the things which Noelle was just talking about, which is think about how racism and other forms of discrimination really take place in spaces that are considered to be, spaces like women and gender studies that are fighting oppression, but that they often end up perpetuating that same oppression they're fighting against. And that's something, that we tried to take on by titling the book Antagonizing White Feminism and thinking about, why are we using that term white feminism as opposed to just thinking about feminism per se. To really mark the ways in which feminism throughout its history, its long history in the United States specifically, continues to have a problem of exclusion, particularly women of color. And how in particular have we seen that happen in the past 2 or 3 or 4 years specifically? And because it keeps returning as this problem that never seems to effectively get addressed and resolved, Noelle and I are like, we really need to push hard to think about the ways in which women's studies often wants to center a problem of oppression against women in terms of gender, but doesn't think about all the other ways in which Black women, women of color, Indigenous women experience multiple forms of oppression in their lives. And how is it that when we began to push back against how these spaces can still feel oppressive, even if they're fighting against that oppression, can we really begin to deconstruct, take apart, make these spaces feel inclusive in the way that they're meant to be, but leave women of color simply checking out, not wanting to participate or feel like they're seen or heard or able to have their issues included.
How interesting that there are so many layers of oppression or layers of needing to be more inclusive, even within the areas that you think are already being inclusive. So that's sort of telling in the moment we're in. And in the book, you talk about cross-racial dialogues, and you and Noelle, Noelle's Black and you're white, and how has your friendship and your relationship shaped the work?
Well,
Beth, do you want to answer?
Let me go first. And then Noelle can jump on. I think it's been foundational because, one of the things that we've really thought about in the book is, how do we think about relationships and not presume that they exist or presume that we understand each other or presume that we have some kind of connection you know, often that is the case where, especially if you're working in like movement building space, like, you know, work in, for example, Black Lives Matter movement, now the global network for the Black Lives Matter group, or in gender studies spaces that, you know, we expect some kind of solidarity to exist. So I think, you know, what our relationship over the many years that we've been working together, and this book is just one kind of manifestation of that, has really, you know, been to think about what's the emotional work, you know, that brings us together. How do we talk to each other? You know, there's been times when Noel has asked me to rethink something, and maybe that has, you know, made me a little uncomfortable, but I just often will sit with that discomfort and think about where it comes from. And that's been really transformative in terms of thinking about how we can hear other people's perspectives, different experiences, different identities, and forge some kind of solidarity between each other.
Noel, right? Did you want to weigh in on that discomfort? Is that good for the conversation?
I think it's necessary. I think over the years, I think Beth and I have been working together now a decade, and we started our work together thinking about Africana studies and being part of the intellectual conversation about those spaces and programs and dynamics. And we would hit speed bumps. And it's been a really great place for me to draw on a better understanding, a better ability to anticipate where those speed bumps might be, but also trying on the conversation from the side of the person who's being negatively impacted in that moment with someone who has been gracious and safe and evolved. I think we both have evolved in that relationship, but what I know is that there is a moment that leads us to the book and to the writing where I hear Beth say, I have been, you know, willfully and consciously and unconsciously contributing to this issue. And to hear her name herself and her behaviors with some really overt, hard language. You know, hearing someone I'm in solidarity with for the first time talk about their racism, mm-hmm. Is a soul healing moment. But it's also the space where I can go and test the pulse of white folks that I am anticipating working with, or, you know, and Beth's willingness to not only be uncomfortable, but let me know what the discomfort is, name the discomfort, and let me be in the space as she works through it, so I can actually hear what that sounds like. And hopefully I'm providing a similar space for Beth to hear what it sounds like when I have to work through racism and you know, black female anti-exclusionary behaviors and targeting.
Mm-hmm. Now, both of you are immersed in all of this. You're in the academic world and you're talking and writing about it. But there's a lot of terminology and a lot of ideas these days that people are kind of scared to talk about. They don't want to sound like they're not woke or they're not politically correct. One of them is anti-racism. Can you talk about that term that author and historian Ibram X. Kendi has made well known with his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist? What is anti-racism? What does that mean?
As I understand Kendi and as I understand the conversations that I'm involved in daily, anti-racism is directly naming the behavior and action that one must take, that systems must take, that institutions must take to end racism. I have a strong preference for the term anti-racism over terms like racial equity, because anti-racism centers the thing. It centers the problem. It centers the behavior, and it names the people who are responsible for fixing that behavior versus the way in which racial equity creates these spaces that I think sometimes are more comfortable. They're more comfortable conversations because we're imagining a route to success, right, that white folks can take to be better people. Anti-racism calls us to look at the very specific action 400 years worth that white folks need to grapple with and deconstruct because they built it in a particular way. Kendi is talking to us a lot about anti-racist policies mm-hmm. and the ways in which we can push into our organizations, institutions, and communities and look at the ways in which policies are keeping racism and racist interactions and exclusions in place. I broaden that for folks to consider that the individual role in racist behavior and the ways in which they need to peel back the layers of the ways in which they're propping up racism in their daily interactions, even in the absence of Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
And that's something I want to talk about quite a bit more after the break. But before the break, let's try to go to a call. This is Todd calling from Bristol. Hi, Todd. What did you want to talk about?
Hi, yes. After George Floyd's death, I called a dear old friend who happens to be Black, and I reminded him that I wasn't a racist. He said something quite powerful to me. He said, "I know, Todd, but it's no longer enough to not be racist. You know that coworker, that distant family member, that neighbor who said something that made you uncomfortable, maybe even quite some time ago? I bet you ignored it, hoped it would go away, thought it best to not begin an argument. As a white person, that is exactly what I need you to do. Find that person, confront them politely, correct them sternly. Racism is taught. It can be untaught. Go find the people you can teach it to."
Thank you, Todd, for sharing that. That's a big question a lot of people have is, what do you do as an individual if someone you know says something, does something racist? Do you confront them? Do you ignore it? Do you cancel that person from social media? Beth, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, thanks so much for that comment from the caller. It's really important to think about all the ways in which white people are showing up in this moment, that often, you know, it can be really easy to maybe say or call yourself an ally in anti-racism. But when things are the most critical, often we see a lot of white people checking out. And so just as the caller said, that it's really important to stand up when you hear something, not just to kind of go home later and kind of think about it or wish you had said something. And that particularly over, you know, the past several years, I've seen a lot of people who are unfriending their contacts on Facebook or friends or whoever says something they don't like, rather than engaging in the conversation, pushing that conversation further. And, you know, in some ways, I want to challenge everyone to think about how this is the work that should be happening on many different levels, right? With, if you're in some kind of social network with someone, you've known them for a reason, they're there, you are the person that has the ability to speak to them, right? Rather than, say, someone who might have a confrontation on the street or during a protest, you've already had some kind of connection or relationship to this person, and they're going to be able to at least begin to hear you in some way. So in thinking about white privilege, right? White privilege is something that, as some scholars like to say, is kind of like a bank, right? It's constantly filling back up. Bettina Love talks about it as an ATM that you can constantly take cash out of. So if you have that privilege,
better to take it and use it. You're going to have that much more privilege just still up in the bank tomorrow. That's why, you know, we're really kind of challenging people to think about how they can, say, for example, in the book, antagonize white feminism, how you can be an anti-racist, and even in many kind of small personal interactions in your daily experiences.
Okay, thanks for that question, Todd. And we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back, and we'll go to more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Audubon, showcasing native plants that support Maine's wildlife and habitat through their online native plants sale, maineaudubon.org. And Maine Community Foundation, working with donors to expedite funding to nonprofits in this unprecedented time. Learn more at mainecf.org.
When back to school doesn't mean back in school, parents feel the squeeze.
We're trying to help our kid. We're trying to do our job that we're getting paid for.
Lots of rounds of tears.
How is it going to affect our children, you know, long term? It's terrifying.
There just aren't enough hours in the day to do all of it.
Bracing for more distance learning this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. On the next Speaking in Maine, extremism in the 21st century.
The U.S. is actually not that different from any of these countries that you and I are talking about right now.
Join us for a discussion on the challenge of extremism with Jasmine El Gamal, Atlantic Council Senior Fellow, and Nick Dowling, founder and CEO of IDS International. This program is from the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? That's Friday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, a conversation about racial justice and ways to help promote racial equality. My guests are Noelle Chaddock, Vice President of Equity and Inclusion at Bates College, and Beth Hinderleiter, Assistant Professor at James Madison University. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And the call earlier from Todd prompted you, Beth, to talk about allies or white allies. It's become a more commonly used term these days where you support a group that you're not part of. Maybe you're white and it's a group of people of color. There's this idea that a white ally can be well-meaning, but may not really get how to do the work of being anti-racist. So if someone's well-meaning and tries to learn and tries to help, what more can they do to count as a true ally, Noelle?
So in our book, Antagonizing White Feminism, we actually have a chapter. Beth and I sat down 5-6 years ago, right after, about 4 years ago, right after the 2016 election, and had a really deep conversation. I was very frustrated. I was exhausted. I had experienced this moment where folks who had identified themselves as allies, white folks who identified themselves as allies, had disappeared. They dropped out of sight. And I was working 16 to 18 hours daily supporting students, faculty, and staff who were impacted in a multiplicity of ways after the election. And folks kept telling me they needed to practice self-care. But they were unable to see me as a black woman doing this unbelievable amount of labor without assistance as folks took care of themselves. And I told Beth, I remember this conversation, that no one had asked me how I was doing what I needed. And so what we started to talk about is the ways in which allyship and our LGBTQAIP2+ folks and queer studies folks have been saying this for quite some time, as well as black feminists since the beginning of time, that this allyship, right, this naming of oneself as an ally is where the problem starts. And it centers the ally, and it does not center the folks that they're trying to support or be in solidarity with. And it creates this huge opportunity for that ally to completely miss their own implicit behaviors that are very often anti-Black and racist. And so we see this in the women's marches and the organization of the women's marches that happen after the 2016 election, where white allies, white feminists start to organize and forget to include Black women and Black female identified folks and Black feminists altogether. And so there's this tension, and it's very public tension. The Pantsuit Nation kind of starts to come unraveled on Facebook around this tension between Black and white female-identified folks. And the white female-identified folks are continuing to claim their feminism and their allyship as anti-racist spaces. And they are not. They're actually anti-Black spaces and very toxic and harmful to the Black female-identified folks who are trying to occupy that space with them. So at this point, I think Beth and I denounce this idea of allyship altogether. I think folks are looking for co-conspirators. Folks are looking for individuals who are willing to do the examination of self that allows them to be in community in ways that they are doing equal, proportional, which sometimes means they're lifting more, but they're lifting together. And the ways in which I've kind of talked through this over the summer in my institution has been for folks to really spend time thinking about the absence of racial diversity in their life, who comes to your backyard wine and beer evenings and dinners, and who's at your weddings and who's at your birthdays. And this isn't a call to chase Black folks down to diversify your friend group. It's a deep self-reflection, and the question that folks who really want to do this work together might ask, how did they end up in a space that is racially homogeneous, singularly white racial spaces, and then really think about what they need to undo to get to a place where they're truly in community with the folks that they want to help. Allyship can be put on in the morning and taken off in the evening, and we can skip days in between. And that is not what's going to get us to a place where anti-racism is the goal and the center of the work we're doing.
So the, it's a tricky thing here in Maine, being a very white state, for people to actually have authentic relationships with someone who's not white. And like you said, maybe in order to do that, they're actually actively chasing somebody down to be their friend, but that at that point, is it authentic or is it a token friendship? So how does someone go about forming authentic relationships and being around others of diverse backgrounds?
So the work that I'm doing with our institution and all of our senior team and the president are involved in is, you know, making sure that when we are making hiring decisions, when we're inviting folks to our campus, when we're building our community, that we are intentionally looking at the ways in which we are reproducing this all-white space in Maine. My challenge to Maine is it's not enough to say that Maine is white, second whitest state in the union, I believe. It is imperative that we figure out how we got that way. And so it's a much deeper dive, I think, than people realize. And it takes some really hard looks at the structures and behaviors that have kept diversity of folks from arriving. And then it's also a really deep look at and a listening to. I've only been here a year, and I've heard all kinds of stories from people of color about how Maine receives them. So the information is there. People are telling us what we're doing and what we're not doing, and people are naming it as racism. And we have to pay attention to how we're responding to that, if we're even listening to that at all. And again, I would say that, you know, who reports to you? Who are your direct supervisors? What do the downlines in your organizations look like? Because that's normally how spaces diversify racially, gender, orientation, nationality, etc. And if we are not paying attention to that, and if we're not willing to reckon with the ways in which we have kept our spaces white, the question about Maine actually doesn't make sense.
Hmm. So now that you've mentioned some concrete examples of things that you can do in the right direction, I'll go to this email from Sally. I'm part of a group of alumni writing a letter to our town's school board about how we think our education could have been more anti-racist. We are caught between the need to make our letter more palatable to a critical but defensive audience so that we can get more of these people on board, and the realization that if we do that, we might be compromising the very ethos and intention of this work. Do you have any tips for how to work within the system while also trying to move past it at the same time?
Data is your friend.
That's interesting. And what do you mean by that?
So I think there's a way that every 5 years or so, organizations who are well-meaning and imagine themselves to be part of the solution go through this moment where they start to talk about not having enough racial diversity in their institutions, in their decision-making spaces. And they always hit a wall, because the conversation becomes about opinions, perspectives, lived experiences. Data in that space is essential. When organizations look at their racial diversity over time, who's been hired, who's been retained, who has left, who has been fired, who has been promoted, who are in management level positions, who's leading your organization, you can start to see the data trends, and you can see those cyclic blips of the people of color who have been brought into the institution. And in most institutions that I've been consulting with, you also can see where they attrition out of that space. So data is your friend, because it's a concrete place to start your conversation based on facts and not the emotional discomfort of white folks in that conversation.
That's very similar to
I
journalism.
Have one example of a friend of mine who works in a hospital and recently did a study of prescription of pain medicines by physicians in the hospital, and was able to take that data collected from the study to different physicians and say, look how you are consistently prescribing lower amounts of pain medication to people of color. And we know that historically that's been a case. He's gotten pushback from the doctors who say, no, I would never do that. I know about racial biases in pain medication and the histories of in the United States of people considering that people of color have higher tolerances to pain. I don't do that. But with that data in hand, right, the doctors were able to really hold that information and hold themselves accountable. Like, they were really doing that despite all of their good intentions and kind of knowledge of the history of inadequate or unequal pain medication prescriptions in the United States.
That's interesting. We have an email from Jonathan following up on what you were talking about earlier. What's the difference between allyship and co-conspirator? I'm still somewhat confused about the difference. Can you offer an example?
I can. So when we are looking at the demonstrations that are still happening across the country, I had a moment when I was watching some black youth kneeling down at the line between them and the police department. And armed police on one side, black male-identified youth on the other side. And there's this moment where a white-identified person walks in front of the black youth and stands in front of them.
And I thought, I've been waiting for a concrete example to help folks figure out the difference. And other white folks then followed, right? Mm-hmm. So they were putting their lives and they were putting their freedom on the line. And the deeper context there is they were leveraging their white privilege because they had a sense that they would not be harmed because they were white.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And in Portland, too, during all of the protests that have taken place in Portland in the summer months, right, they had so-called wall of mothers, a lot of white women who felt like they could stand in the front line against police using tear gas, et cetera, and to use their privilege with the sense that maybe they wouldn't be tear gassed, right, in that particular moment.
Of course, this is the other Portland, as a reminder.
The other Portland.
We're in Maine. Okay, we do need to go to another quick break. So much to talk about. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Now You're Cooking, selling cookware, kitchen tools, and fine wine on Front Street in downtown Bath. Open 7 days a week, now offering curbside pickup and shopping by appointment. Acadia Family Center in Southwest Harbor, dedicated to treatment, recovery, and well-being for those facing mental health issues or the disease of addiction. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com.
On August 13, 1884, painter and inventor Rufus M. Porter died. Porter, born in 1792, began his artistic life as a decorative painter and painter of portraits and later branched into murals. He painted what he knew, landscapes depicting the farms around Bridgeton, his childhood home, and seaport scenes of Portland, where he lived and studied as a young man. A prolific inventor, his design for a revolving rifle cylinder was sold to Samuel Colt, helping to revolutionize the munitions industry. He founded the magazine Scientific American in 1845 to encourage innovation in American arts and sciences.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Dean Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine! The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is on a twice-a-week schedule on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is normally scheduled for Tuesday and Thursdays each week and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about ways to confront racism. Joining me, Dr. Beth Hinterleiter, Assistant Professor at James Madison University, and Noel Chaddick, Vice President of Equity and Inclusion at Bates College. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. And we'll go now to a call. This is Frederick calling from Bath. Hi, Frederick. What did you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Cindy and guests. Cindy, it's so nice to hear you on this side of the phone, by the way, hosting the program.
Yes, Frederick. I've talked to you on the other side of the phone before. Thanks. What did you want to ask our panelists?
Well, I wanted to offer a thought about a personal potential for us all from a lecturer who wrote The Fragility of Whiteness. The Maine Jung Center connected people to a Zoom of hers where she described that this society is a racist society. Let's just begin with that fact. Oh, yeah, I have for so long known of our tradition with slavery and with Native peoples. I mean, I've intellectually understood that. And then when she said, this is simply a racist society, and then I look at our capitalism and our economy, and it is a racist economic system, then I've been able to somewhat just sit into that place of, please just let go of my any sense of defensiveness and look at my culpability and my opportunity to say, well, please tell me more about that, or I'm sorry if you have that feeling from what I've said.
Well, thanks for sharing
the
that, Frederick.
The other thing that I wanted, Cindy, if I could, the other thing that I wanted to share was Joe Biden said something truly remarkable many, many weeks ago. And he said, we've been here 400 years. And there was no prompting of Joe Biden to say that we have had this history of 400 years. And it is so opening and heart-opening to me to see that he has the back of an Indian American and a Black American as his running mate. And may we all open to this possibility I would offer.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Frederick. And Beth, I just wanted to see if you could answer this idea that, well, if you just acknowledge, well, we're just a racist society, period, does that in some ways liberate people?
Thank you, Frederick, for the call. I think it's really critical for us to think about how racism operates differently than bias or prejudice, that we're talking about institutions, you know, whether that's in banking, is it in education, all of our different social and cultural institutions that have perpetuated oppression. And when we start to think about white fragility from the book popularized by Robin DiAngelo, we're bringing whiteness back into the center stage of the conversation. And we're psychologizing it, you know, wondering why are white people fragile if they hear this, or why are white people not able to talk about racial issues. We're not necessarily taking that conversation to thinking about deconstructing institutions. Why is it that people like Robin DiAngelo or Tim Wise are now sitting in boardrooms of major companies doing diversity training all across the United States and across the world? When they're saying things that people of color have been saying for a really long time, but they're not saying it to roomfuls of white people, and they're getting paid like a lot for the work that they've been doing. So that's one of my challenges, I think, to how we're often rebringing, you know, bringing a kind of psychology of whiteness into the conversation without thinking about the institutions of whiteness. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what we really need to do is to consider how in all of our conversations and all of our daily experiences, how do white people in particular really need to think about how whiteness, which is often the default, it's neutral, it's often unmarked, it's not noticed as people of color are marked or othered. How can we begin to mark whiteness? How do we make whiteness apparent? How do we make that whiteness visible? So that, as Frederick said, you know, let go of that, whether it's the defensiveness or the more we do that, right, we don't need to think about the fragility of it, right?
Okay. Thanks for your call, Frederick. And just following up on what you just said, Beth, we do have an email from Joe mentioning the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And he said, as a white male, I found this book extremely eye-opening and a great description of what racism is and how it is an innate part of practically all white people. So there is that, right? I mean, it's accomplishing an awareness and a consciousness to bring up these issues. Noelle?
You know, I think I co-sign everything that Beth just said. You know, and I have used white fragility in my institution, but I have been painfully aware of the negative impact that has had on our scholars of color.
Mm-hmm.
Because to hear white people say, oh, I finally get it. This is the first time that I've heard it. This is the first time that I've understood it, is a profound erasure of the work that black people have done in this country for hundreds of years. And I think it's an entryway. I'm contemplating whether or not it was an entryway that was too easy because people in my position understood that white people would hear it. And I think it is a necessary thing for white folks to grapple with. And at the same time, you know, it is saying that my white community cannot hear me. The people I've come here to lead cannot hear this from my body and my voice. And so this summer we spent time with that particular question. And I'm amazed at what the folks at Bates have been able to do when they stop and appreciate that that's a reality for them and the ways in which we have a lot of work to do at Bates in Maine around recentering, right? That intersectional call to recenter Black, Indigenous, people of color's voices, bodies, and leadership in the very work that we are the object of. And I also would say, you know, to Fred's point, something that really resonated with me that I wanted to share was, you know, If folks are still not quite there, still not quite getting the structural realities of the United States and its founding on the backs and bodies and lives of Black people, and as that continues, and I would say Black and Indigenous people specifically, think about the 13th Amendment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ways in which Black folks in the United States are citizens and whole humans by amendment, not by constitution, like their white male peers. So that, for me, is a really interesting possibility to think about. Philadelphia has a beautiful walking tour that you can do, and one of the placards is imprinted on my brain, and it's talking about the ways in which enslaved Black folks took the head of the country, the White House, and they physically dismantle it in Philadelphia and move it to Washington, D.C., the physical labor. And if we look at our institutions in the United States, education, colleges, also built on the backs and lives and labor of Black people, and we still are struggling to figure out what the problem is in ways that, you know, Black folks, Indigenous folks, and people of color have been telling us for a very, very long time. And so I think that's a place for some reckoning for white folks and some of that self-reflection. One of the greatest questions that was asked of me in the last 3 months was by one of my very best friends, been my best friend for 10 years. She happens to be a white woman. And she asked me if I had ever harmed her, if she had ever harmed me.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you know, I'm starting to understand racism and whiteness, and I'm terrified that I have been harming you, and I want you to tell me, have I ever done racist things to you? And I had to make a decision, and I asked Beth what she thought of that question, and we had that conversation, and that was very difficult for me because I had been protecting her from her own racism for 10 years. So if you are in community with folks, work, social life, anticipation of that, think about that question. It's a very brave question, but when folks are looking for deep, substantive changes, that's an interesting orientation point. And the last thing I'll say is Black, Indigenous people of color are sharing trauma around being in spaces where white folks are having these aha moments, are shocked and in awe. I shared that recently, and there was some pushback, right, that that their learning would be characterized as shock and awe. But I think that's also a really important question. What does the performance of shock look like around people who are in imminent danger because of racism in our country?
Well, that brings me to the question about not only the protests, the removal of Confederate statues and buildings being renamed and corporate logos and all the things that sort of this jolt to the system has set into motion. What do you think of those, and what counts, in the couple minutes we have left, what counts as helpful, useful, real forward movement in anti-racist efforts?
I'm going to let Beth answer this. She's sitting very close to Richmond.
And unfortunately, we only have a minute or so, but yeah.
Okay.
The only quick thing I want to say is let's be careful about how much we celebrate doing something that should have already been done.
Beth?
Yes, so true. I think that we all celebrate statues coming down that don't represent our values, but let's think that the statue is a symbol. And we need to think about the actual violence that the symbol represents. And that, I mean, maybe I'll just keep it short there.
Well, okay, then let me squeeze in another super quick question. What does racial healing look like?
For me, it's watching white folks do the deep work that allow them to show up and do equal lifting and share the labor of the healing. I don't think it's on Black, Indigenous people of color to heal ourselves, and I don't think we can do that.
Okay, so that leaves a tantalizing note to end on, but so much more I wish
right.
we could talk about. I think, Beth, we're kind of...
The last thing would be
go ahead, real quick.
To have formal apologies and reparations. I mean, that's very important, too.
Okay. I wish we could continue the conversation, but we're out of time. So, Noelle, Beth, thank you both for joining us today. Noelle Chaddock is the Vice President of Equity and Inclusion at Bates College, and Beth Hinderleiter is an Assistant Professor at James Madison University. Stay with us for today's briefing with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. That's next on Maine Public Radio and Television, online, and on Facebook. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's Maine Calling program will be rebroadcast at 7, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.org. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.